Next, we have Dr. Neil Soto. He is an assistant professor of surgery at Brown University School of Medicine. He's also a director of the ICU, CVC ICU at Lifespan. He's going to be talking about serum-based molecular markers of post-cardiopulmonary bypass neurologic injury.
Good morning. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. I have no disclosures. Today, I'd like to talk briefly about defining neurocognitive dysfunction after cardiac surgery and some of our work and the work of others investigating blood-based biomarkers, which can be used to help predict or diagnose neurocognitive dysfunction, and also review some of the work we've done in genomic studies to identify markers of neurocognitive dysfunction. So neurologic injury after cardiac surgery is classified into two types. Type one is the one that's more commonly recognized, and this is a transient ischemic attack, stroke, coma, or a fatal neurologic complication, and generally has an incidence of about 1.5% to 3.5%, depending on the operation. This is less common than type two injury, but again is more readily apparent clinically. Type 2, which is the focus of my research, really includes delirium and what we call postoperative neurocognitive dysfunction. This involves deficits with memory, attention, concentration, perception, motor performance, visual-spatial relationships, and language. Type 2 injury is much more common than type 1, but much less frequently diagnosed. We can see it in up to about 50% of patients at the time of discharge around postoperative day 5 or 6. Generally, this subsides at about 1 month, with 25% of patients demonstrating some neurocognitive deficit, and most patients will have returned to baseline at about 1 year. So with this seeming like a somewhat benign process at 1 year, why is it important? Multiple studies have shown that patients and complain of decreased quality of life when they experience neurocognitive deficits. Patients have been demonstrated to have earlier withdrawal from the workforce, earlier retirement, and also increased dependency on others for performance of activities of daily living. Currently, we can diagnose neurocognitive dysfunction with a multi-panel assessment, which is aimed at various aspects of cognition administered over multiple time points. Essentially, patients take a neurocognitive battery of tests preoperatively and then at multiple time points after surgery. And if they demonstrate a deficit in 25% of the tests that they take, which is greater than one standard deviation from their baseline, they're determined to have suffered from some degree of neurocognitive deficit. So the phenomenon is readily identifiable with neurocognitive testing, but what causes type 2 injury? We know that there are some non-modifiable risk factors based on clinical trials, such as increasing age, preoperative neurocognitive deficit. Interestingly, level of education is controversial. Some studies have shown that people who have higher levels of education actually demonstrate more deficit, whereas others have shown people with lower levels of education demonstrate more deficit. And this is partly based on a floor-to-ceiling effect. If you're starting off at a higher level, you may have more room to drop. Additionally, cerebrovascular disease, chronic kidney disease, and left ventricular dysfunction have been identified as being associated with postoperative neurocognitive dysfunction. Looking at modifiable risk factors, intraoperative temperature control, where moderate hypothermia may be protective, glucose control, avoiding hypotension intraoperatively, minimizing anemia, meaning hemoglobin below 18 intraoperatively, use of coated cardiopulmonary bypass circuits, and minimizing the risk of atheroembolization is thought to play a role in reducing neurocognitive injury. But really, optimization of all of the above has not significantly reduced the rates of neurocognitive dysfunction over the last 20 years in multiple studies. So multiple hypotheses have been generated. It's clearly a multifactorial process. Microembolization was really thought to be the leading driver of neurocognitive dysfunction, but subsequently, multiple studies looking at MRI and functional MRI have demonstrated no correlation between embolic load or anatomic localization of embolic load to the areas of deficit. Vasomotor dysfunction has also been thought to play a role with dysregulation in the cerebral microvasculature, and really a catch-all of inflammation and free radical injury. It seems like in cardiac surgery, almost everything that's blamed on cardiopulmonary bypass has to do with inflammation and free radical injury. But the general thought was, well, if we see inflammation, free radical injury inducing issues with the heart and peripheral organs, maybe it's occurring in the brain as well. And so initial studies aim to identify predictive biomarkers in the blood for risk stratification. Essentially, were there lab values that you could find that could help you determine what someone's risk of postoperative neurocognitive dysfunction would be? And two, were there biomarkers of brain injury which you could obtain postoperatively which would establish a diagnosis of neurocognitive dysfunction to avoid requiring the battery of neurocognitive assessments, which are quite labor-intensive? So briefly, I'll go over the work we've done over the last several years looking at blood biomarkers of neurocognitive dysfunction and also provide a high-level summary of the work that's been done in some other labs. And so we've looked at 72 patients undergoing coronary artery bypass grafting, isolated aortic valve replacement, mitral valve replacement, or a combination of CABG or valve, and collected blood preoperatively at 6 hours, postoperatively, and 4 days after surgery. All patients underwent neurocognitive testing at prior to surgery within, again, 1 week of surgery and 30 days postoperatively. Patients that had aortic calcification, a history of stroke, baseline neurocognitive deficits, cirrhosis, or chronic kidney disease were excluded. And in two separate cohorts, we've found that rates of neurocognitive dysfunction were consistent with prior reports at about 50% on postoperative day five. And really, to provide a summary of all the different markers we looked at, we broke down markers of inflammation and markers of neurologic injury. And really, we found that the only preoperative marker of inflammation that was elevated between patients who developed postoperative neurocognitive dysfunction and patients who did not was a CRP, which is, you know, fairly nonspecific. When looking at serologic markers of inflammation postoperatively, we found that levels of IL-10 and IL-8 were elevated in addition to increases in CRP, but C3a, TNF-alpha, total peroxide, none of these really changed. We looked at basically troponins of the brain or markers of brain injury, which have been validated in stroke studies and studies of traumatic brain injury. And we found that S100 beta was no different at baseline between patients who did and did not develop neurocognitive dysfunction. But neuron-specific enolase was elevated at baseline. Tau protein was no different between the groups. Postoperatively, we found significant increases in tau protein and neuron-specific enolase about twofold from baseline in patients who developed postoperative neurocognitive dysfunction. Here, basically, I've summarized 18 other papers which have looked at a similar process encompassing about 1,500 patients. And other investigators have really found no difference between preoperative values of inflammatory markers in patients who develop neurocognitive dysfunction and who do not. This differed from our data specifically in that we found that there was an elevation in CRP preoperatively, but otherwise was fairly similar. CRP was elevated postoperatively, but other investigators have found IL-6 and 18 were elevated as well. Other series which have looked at blood markers of brain injury examined S100 beta and found no difference between the two, and neuron-specific enolase again, which was elevated preoperatively in patients with neurocognitive dysfunction, but two other papers with a total of about 150 patients found no difference. So at this point, we're left with non-specific markers of neurocognitive dysfunction. We really couldn't find a lab test which would predict who would get it, or a combination of lab tests that would predict who would develop neurocognitive dysfunction, nor could we identify a reliable marker postoperatively that would identify patients who may have developed it. And so we started on, you know, a fishing expedition, casting a wider net, and that can be a criticism of many genomic studies. So Essentially, we took preoperative blood samples and postoperative blood samples described previously, and took a genomic approach looking at the transcriptosome. Basically, RNA was isolated from the blood, cDNA copies were made, they were labeled and hybridized to a microarray, and we were able to determine expression levels of genes pre relative to post and between groups. Interestingly, the cost of this when we started doing it was about five or six times higher, and this is from the National Human Genome Research Institute. And when you look at the cost of genome sequencing relative to Moore's Law, you can see it's accelerating at an even more rapid pace. And now for our animal studies, we can sequence a genome for about $500 a pig, and for patients, it's still about $800 or $900. But we've previously published on 42 patients in whom we'd performed genomic studies. And again, blood was drawn prior to surgery and 6 hours postoperatively. We formed gene expression assays with an Affymetrix gene chip and validated these with real-time PCR. We used two different analytic software tools. One was D-Chip and one was GMP Genomics. And so once the genetic data is analyzed, you're flooded with thousands of genes which are differentially regulated. And so we used the Ingenuity Pathways database to look at gene ontology to identify overall pathways which may be affected. To limit false discovery, we performed ANOVA testing with multiple comparisons to limit our rate to less than 0.05. To summarize the studies, we found that in patients at baseline, there was a difference of about 140 genes in terms of transcription levels between those patients who developed neurocognitive dysfunction and those patients who did not. These were primarily related to inflammation and cell death, and some of these which demonstrated the greatest differences included ADA, CD3E, CD3G, NFAC2, STAT4, and E2F2. And when we say the greatest differences, we set our minimal threshold as a 1.5-fold difference, but these demonstrated 2 to 3-fold differences. In patients who developed neurocognitive dysfunction, samples obtained 6 hours postoperatively demonstrated upregulation of 531 genes and downregulation of 670 genes. And in patients who developed no neurocognitive dysfunction, at 6 hours, 2,214 genes were upregulated and 558 were downregulated. And so as I said before, this is a huge amount of data to get and really very difficult to manage. And so using gene ontologic pathways, we isolated cellular signaling related to inflammation, cell adhesion, and apoptosis as common pathways in the most common genes which are differentially regulated. Here's an example of some of the ontologic pathways. And so you can see, again, some related to apoptosis, cell adhesion, and inflammation. Additional groups have looked at genomic studies evaluating neurocognitive dysfunction, but have really taken a more focused approach. The Matthew group down at Duke looked at SNPs for both CRP and P-selectin and found that preoperatively patients with certain SNPs for these two were demonstrated to have a 2-fold higher risk for neurocognitive dysfunction after surgery. There was a lot of interest about 10 to 15 years ago in looking at apolipoprotein E4, given its role in the development of Alzheimer's disease as a predictive marker for developing neurocognitive dysfunction. And the initial studies of about 30 patients demonstrated that this was a promising marker, but subsequent studies for about 300 patients have demonstrated no significant impact on early postoperative neurocognitive dysfunction. Several years ago, Dr. Bartels from the Duke group looked at outcomes, neurocognitive outcomes 5 years out, and found that there was an association with the apolipoprotein E4 allele, but this was not demonstrated in early dysfunction. So currently in our lab, we're continuing to enroll patients to look at long-term testing at 6 months and 1 year and using new microarray gene chips. And we've developed a porcine model for the assessment of neurologic injury. Basically, it allows us direct access to brain tissue, which has been a limitation of of the human studies. In conclusion, elevated preoperative neuron-specific enolase and C-reactive protein are associated with postoperative neurocognitive dysfunction but lack specificity for clinical utility. Postoperative tau protein levels may offer the best sensitivity and specificity as a marker for postoperative neurocognitive dysfunction. Pro-inflammatory cytokines are elevated in patients who develop postoperative NCD but remain nonspecific. Genomic studies have demonstrated significant differences in gene regulation between patients who do and do not develop NCD, but application of the results is really hampered by the magnitude of the genes differentially expressed. Current gene ontologic pathways have identified pathways involving inflammation, cell adhesion, and cell signaling, cell death signaling to be involved with NCD. Thank you.
So Neil, it's really nice to see a cardiac surgeon working on this topic. We usually see cardiac anesthesiologists focusing on this. And I would say that with the progression in the safety of cardiac surgery, especially from a mortality standpoint, this is now the most commonly asked question that I receive in the pre-op clinic. Everyone wants to know if their brain is going to be okay. They're far less worried about dying. So this is a very important topic that you're on. You mentioned that you can sequence patients now for about $800. And if you think about how much it costs to get a type-in screen or even a panel 7 or something, it's really not that different than the standard preoperative labs now. Is it still too early, or is it irresponsible for us to be proactive or maybe preemptive and just start sequencing patients, comparing to your various interactomes, and just giving people a very, very non-specific, non-sensitive estimate to reassure them, to answer their general question, not to give them specific numbers?
I do think it's too early, because a lot of the transcriptome data that we have shows 1.5, twofold increases, and even though the mRNA levels may be higher, this doesn't necessarily translate to protein levels. And basically, when you look at all of the studies that have assessed genomic pathway analysis in patients who have had neurocognitive testing, we're looking at about 1,500 patients total in 15 years, and so the numbers are so small. And one of the problems is there have been a lot of studies in cardiac surgery where genomic analysis has been performed, but so few have performed neurocognitive testing that we've got such a small sample size that I don't think we can draw any conclusions from the data we have available.
Still too early.
Any other questions or comments?
When we compared between the groups, we looked at aspirin, statin, beta blockers, ACE inhibitors, and steroids, and found that there was really no effect on preoperative markers of inflammation. We excluded patients who were coming in for emergency surgery, but again, the list of things that can affect CRP is extraordinarily long, and so even though it is associated, it's so nonspecific, it's just not helpful.
But, yep.
You know, a number of interventions have actually been tried. People have tried lidocaine, ketamine, steroids, a couple of monoclonal antibodies, and these are small trials, 10 or 12 patients, and so whether they reach statistical validity, statistical validity remains in question, but none of them have been really shown to be of benefit. I think here the next steps are twofold. One, we need to increase the size of the data set. And so once we can get about 700 to 800 patients, that was a power calculation we did, we'll be able to get a better idea of which gene pathways are the most significant. And then I think you go back away from the genes, looking at actual protein signaling in those pathways, whether it's cell adhesion signaling pathways, to identify what a therapeutic target is. And two, not having been able to assess the brain directly, you know, some studies have actually drawn CSF on patients pre-op and post-op. European studies, I don't think that'll fly here. But this is all associative. That none of it is causative, and so that's one of the reasons we've been using a pig model in the lab, because we can get brain samples. All right, thank you.